Well, it's good to see all of you. It was especially good to hear Mr. Buchanan. I've complained, I don't know how many times, that I never get to hear him speak. I remember here many times in the past, and so that was good. It's interesting, those of us that work in that big, bad old world, I thought I was listening to the mission statement for the company I work for. Different company, same mission. And ours isn't, his isn't pharmaceuticals. His products misapplied can hurt people. I'm in financial services, and people feel like hurting themselves when they have bad things happen in financial services. But we have the same issue going on where I'm working, where we have been fined heavily for not quite doing the right thing and abiding by our own principles. So I enjoyed that very much. Unfortunately, he is somewhat mistaken. You are going to get it again. Funny enough, there's three sections of both the Old and New Testament that we picked the same. So I was doing a little rewrite there, but I think you'll find it very interesting, the subjects that we have picked today. Do you know, this is a wonderful time of year, isn't it? Right? It's a wonderful time of year. In fact, I heard on the radio just this last week from a man named Andy, it's the most wonderful time of the year. I tell you, we made it down here in good shape, but I can't imagine the people that were shopping. We didn't have any big traffic jams except in Temecula where all the gamblers and drinkers were. No, I'm kidding. It's always in Temecula, but we didn't see any cars scattered all over the freeway as we usually do when we come down here. When I came in, Mr. Borrega met me, and he, I think the first part of it was, "Yo me mucho gusto," and, you know, "glad you're here," and then he ended it with the word "tiempo." The word "tiempo," I think, is time, right? Yeah, right. A lot of heads nodding. I said, "Was this some kind of remark that I'm on time?" And some sarcastic remark that I'm finally on time? He said, "Si." Yeah. So he was clutching his chest and asking for air that I was here ahead of time. I knew Mr. Buchanan was speaking, so I wanted to come. Just recently, I got to tell you, speaking of the season of the year, I had to make a presentation to a number of people, and I work in the schools, and they told me to get ready for a group of about 15 people. It turned into 70 people. This shows you what education can do with counting. And what's most interesting, it was all women. And I usually have mixed groups when I speak or make a presentation. And these ladies were having a great, great time. It was the day before their break, the holidays, and there were decorations everywhere. I mean, there were little, scissored trees, little green Christmas trees, and I don't know what half this stuff was, but there was, they'd put a Christmas tree on my laptop, they put one on my books, on my satchel, everything had a Christmas tree on top, and I very carefully, you know, so I could use them, and I wasn't offended. But of course, afterwards, when we got done, I had 50 to 60 people coming up, and they said to me what? "Merry Christmas. Merry Christmas." I wasn't offended. I understand. I celebrated it for 20, 25 years. And I said, "Merry Christmas." But I wanted to, just before we pass through the holiday, you thought this is going to be the 26th, so we won't have anything to do with Christmas. But I wanted to ask you, what do you say when people say Merry Christmas to you? It always seems that, you know, we've been doing this for so long, you'd think we'd have it down pat. And people stammering, what do you say? How do you respond? What is it you say? Well, you could say, when somebody says Merry Christmas, you could say, "Bah humbug." My dad said "Bah humbug" quite regularly every year. You could say to them, "You're confused and under Satan's domination and utter mind control, and would you like a booklet?" You didn't have one out there, I can't believe it, on Christmas. You could say, "That's a pagan holiday, and you will burn long and hot in hell for observing this day." But through my many, many years of practice and being kind and sensitive, which all of you know that I am, I've developed a couple of responses. Let me share them with you. When I'm asked Merry Christmas, I say, "Thank you, but I'm not Catholic. But thank you nonetheless. It is, after all, St. Michael's Mass. And you, by celebrating this day, are basically observing a Catholic feast day, which proves you're under the domination of the Holy Roman Catholic Church as a daughter in rebellion." No, I'm kidding. I don't say that to them. except if I know him real well, then I will. No, I usually say to somebody who says Merry Christmas to me, I usually say Happy Hanukkah. And they come back and they say, but I don't celebrate Hanukkah. And I said, that's okay, I don't celebrate Christmas either. They usually smile, toddle off, they think I'm Jewish. Hey. But I'm not offended, and I sure hope they aren't offended, because as was pointed out, there are some awful nice people who really don't understand, and there's no sensing us completely alienating them by what we believe. One of the most significant aspects of Jesus' ministry, obviously, are his parables. And today what I'd like to do is explore one of them. We're going to hit on two groups of scriptures that Mr. Buchanan spoke about. And in somewhat the same way, but with probably a little different perspective. Today, I want to explore one that's very common. It's called the vineyard, the parable of the vineyard. It has some very uncommon aspects to it that I think sometimes we gloss over. So I'm going to title this today, The Mystery of the Vineyard. If you would, Matthew chapter 21, if you'll turn there with me. And we'll spend the majority of our time in Matthew chapter 21. I love the book of Matthew. It is my favorite by far. I believe that it has just about every pivotal, basic part of our doctrinal theology, as well as how we interact with one another. Good old Matthew 18 is in there as well. But we're going to start Matthew 21. And it begins with, where are we? We're going to start in Matthew 21, and Jesus goes through a number of different illustrations. But he begins in verse 33 with, "Hear another parable. There was a certain landowner who planted a vineyard and set a hedge around it." Now this parable of the vineyard you've heard many, many times. And the allegory, as it's called, or the parable, is about this very common thing, a vineyard. Now, I notice that people, you know, have gone to Arizona, or they may go to Ohio, and they go to New York. There's not a lot of vineyards in Ohio. I've been there many, many times. My wife is from Ohio, but I didn't see many. Now, New York, you go to New York. Anybody from New York? Good, so we can bash New York. Good, nobody's from New York. No, they think they have vineyards. They haven't got any vineyards in New York. But they do have them in California. So this is an analogy. When you hear vineyard, you would understand. We had some friends just yesterday had taken a trip up to the Napa, Sonoma, Mendocino area. And if any of you have been up there, we used to live south of there. It's a gorgeous, gorgeous area. And you see the vineyards are beautiful places. And you see them in movies and on TV. You see the rolling hills, the green everywhere. The green is everywhere. There's order. There's structure, there's cultivation and farming techniques, and of course the produce is great. The grapes, raisins, and what's that other stuff vineyards produce? Oh yeah, wine. And Jesus uses his vineyards often in his stories for an example, but there is a very good reason why. And I want you to hold your hand in Matthew chapter 21 and flip back to Isaiah chapter 5. Now let me tell you a little insight on speakers. Whenever you have these, you know, cherished verses, they're almost like your children. When you're preparing a message, you have these verses, right, guys? And all so you're listening, and then all of a sudden you hear, if Isaiah 5 is one that you're talking from, and you hear the speaker say Isaiah 5, ice cold water runs through your veins, right? Thinking, what section of Isaiah 5 is he going to use? And it probably will be better than what I'm referencing. But Isaiah, I'm going to use a different part of Isaiah 5. So in chapter 5, verse 1, it says, "Now let me sing, says Isaiah, to my well-beloved, a song of my beloved regarding his vineyard." Now the well-beloved here is God. And this is Isaiah singing or praising God. "So a song of my beloved regarding his vineyard. My well-beloved has a vineyard on a very fruitful hill. He dug it up and cleared out its stones and planted it with the choicest vine. He built a tower in its midst and also made a wine press in it. So he expected it to bring forth good grapes, but it brought forth wild grapes." So here we see back in the book of Isaiah, and you can do a real good word study or word search, and you will see vineyard come up again and again. So go back to Matthew chapter 21 again, and we will talk about the vineyard. But before we talk about the vineyard in Matthew chapter 21, I want you to take a quick look. I want you to take a real quick look at verse 23, where it begins the run-up, as we call it, to those verses we talked about earlier. Matthew chapter 21, verse 23. Now when he came to the temple, meaning he, Jesus, the chief priests and the elders of the people confronted him as he was teaching. Now remember where he is and who he's speaking to. People and places. And they said, by what authority are you doing these things? And who gave you this authority? But Jesus answered them and said, I will also ask you one thing, which if you tell me, I will likewise tell you by what authority I do these things. The baptism of John, where was it from? From heaven or from men? Now, Jesus is a masterful debater. He does a wonderful job of a retort. He comes right back at them wonderfully, and he answers a question with a question. He asks a question he knows they are not going to be able to answer. Or if they do, he will have a follow-up, I'm sure. And they reasoned among themselves, saying, if we say from heaven, he'll say to us, why then did you not believe him? But if we say from men, we fear the multitude, for all count John as a prophet. We can't win. So they answered Jesus and said, we don't know. Jesus said to them, and neither will I tell you by what authority I do these things. Jesus now takes the offensive. Remember that the chief priests and the elders, those chief priests and those elders, they don't come to Jesus to learn or to be taught, do they? They usually come to challenge and debate. And so they've asked him about authority. He comes right back with a challenge and the stage is set. And now he goes on the offensive to drive home a point. Verse 28. But what do you think? A man had two sons, and he came to the first and said, son, go work today in my vineyard. There's that analogy again. He answered and said, I will not. But afterward he regretted it and went. Then he came to the second and said, likewise. And he answered and said, I go, sir. But he did not go. Which of the two did the will of his father? They said to him, the first. Now at this point, the they is interesting because it could be referring to the elders, more than likely, because they weren't answering any more questions, it was probably the people. They said to him the first, and Jesus said to them, assuredly I say to you, the tax collectors and harlots enter the kingdom of God before you. Now, I don't want to read into this at all, but I believe it. The Bible is a living document, and it's trying to describe things that happened 2,000 years ago. And I would imagine that after Jesus has answered the chief priests and the elders directly, he turns to the people to tell the story. What do you think? A man had two sons. The first came and said, when he said, go work in my vineyard, he said, I will not. When he gets the answer, they said to him, the first, I believe it was the people. Jesus then said to them, I think he turned back to the scribes and the Pharisees, or the elders, and said, assuredly I say to you that tax collectors and harlots enter the kingdom of God before you. For John came to you in the way of righteousness, and you did not believe him, but tax collectors and harlots believed him. And when you saw it, you did not afterward relent and believe him. He then continues. And here another parable. There was a certain landowner who planted a vineyard and set a hedge around it, dug a wine press in it, and built a tower. Sound familiar? And he leased it to vine dressers and went into a far country. Now when vintage time drew near, he sent his servants to the vineyard, to vine dressers, that they might receive its fruit. And the vine dressers took his servants, beat one, killed one, stoned another. Again he sent other servants, more than the first, and they did likewise to them. The last of all he sent his son to them, saying, they will respect my son. But when the vine dressers saw the son, they said among themselves, this is the heir. Come, let us kill him, seize his inheritance. And so they took him, they cast him out of the vineyard, and they killed him. Therefore, when the owner of the vineyard comes, what will he do to those vine dressers? They said to him, he will destroy those wicked men miserably and lease his vineyard to other vine dressers who will render to him the fruits of their seasons. This is the people answering back, hardly the chief priests and elders. Jesus then said to them, have you never read in the scriptures, the stone which the builders rejected has become the chief cornerstone? This was the eternal's doing. It is marvelous in our eyes. Therefore I say to you, the kingdom of God will be taken from you, given to a nation bearing fruits of it. And whoever falls on this stone shall be broken, but on whomever it falls, it will grind him to powder. Now, when the chief priests and Pharisees heard his parables, they perceived that he was speaking of them. But when they sought to lay hands on him, they feared the multitudes because they took him for a prophet. And they won't know what happened the last time they took someone for a prophet and didn't listen to him. Bookending that with John. These are some of the most, believe it or not, hotly debated verses in all of New Testament scholarship. I tried to do a search of the commentaries that I have, and the information is legion. It just goes on and on and on. Online, there have been papers written, especially in the last 20, 30 years, of who are and who is Jesus speaking to. Who are all the players in this setting? We know it was at the temple. We know that the chief priests, the scribes, and the Pharisees were there. We know the people themselves were there, because it's a series of issues that have to do with all of that. But this is a parable which is also an allegory. And who do they represent? And you'd be very surprised at who are defined and what is defined from this parable. It's very interesting. I'd like to think that we know who the landlord is. I'd like to think we know who the vine dressers are and the servants are. But we're going to go through it, because I think it has something very interesting to say. And again, I think it will dovetail very nicely, hopefully, God is in it with the first message. We know from what we just read in Isaiah 5 and from Jewish texts of the time, the vineyard is Israel. Vineyard is always Israel. It is God's planting. Jerusalem is also part of that vineyard. Judah and the temple. It is God's chosen place for God's chosen people. There's no more loved place in all the world for God. It is the apple of his eye. Is Israel, Jerusalem, the temple, and his people. And it accords with both Isaiah 5 and chapter 21 of Matthew. So we have a pretty good idea that indeed that is the definition for this vineyard in this parable of Jesus. In fact, we have what we call 5 points of concurrence. Both Isaiah 5 and Matthew 21 both mention a vineyard. That was easy. They both mention a wine press. They both mention a tower. And both mention a wall or a hedge, and both mention a fruit or a harvest that is expected. Who is the landowner? Isaiah 5 gives us the clue again. God the Father. It is his vineyard. It is his land. And he is protected. Isaiah tells us very clearly, it is my vineyard. It's something that he has planted. Who are the vine dressers? Now, in the parable, it gets a little sticky. The vine dressers here, the word can mean farmer, grower, harvester, the one who takes care of the grapes. If you've ever tended a garden, you are that person in the original Greek. It's someone who is responsible for the caring of that land. They're also expected to have a product. That's the whole point of planting something. Even when you plant a tree, which may not bear any fruit, you plant the tree for shade. You plant the tree for its beauty. You plant the tree for the birds of the air. There is a reason, there is an objective in planting something. So when the harvest come for this vine dresser, because he's the one that's supposed to take care of it, his job, it's what he does to make sure that the produce is harvested for those to whom it is intended. Isaiah 5 says, in fact, it references those people as the dwellers in Jerusalem and Judah. So we're talking about the same group of people. We'd be speculating, but we can very easily tell in Matthew chapter 21, he is talking very clearly about whom. He's talking about, because they even admit it, the chief priests and the Pharisees who heard his parables. Can you imagine? You know, Shlomo and Saul are talking to each other and they're saying, is he talking about us? Is he referencing us? Is he saying that we are the vine dressers and we've done a bad job and we'll be replaced? Is it us? It was their occupation. It was their job to take care of Israel, to take care of the vineyard, to produce what was expected. They had no casual interest in this. indeed the leaders or the government of any entity do have a very special requirement. We heard, and I understand very well, the leaders or the management of a corporation are the ones usually that will go to jail or will be punished severely. In the state of California, in a prior life that I had, I was involved in some very bad toxic chemistry. We didn't produce it. We sold it. We let other people produce it after what we gave them. But this toxic material had to be recycled. And if it wasn't recycled by the manufacturing entity in the state of California, do you know who goes to jail? Not the operators. The top three officials of that corporation. Why? Gets their attention real carefully when they're going to do prison time in the state of California for violating state and federal laws, especially in the state of California. So it was these men's jobs, the priests and the elders, it was their occupation to take care of the vineyard of Israel. Who were the servants here? It says in verse, if I can see it, in verse 34, now when vintage time drew near, Matthew chapter 21, when vintage time drew near, he sent his servants to the vineyard, to the vine dressers, that they might receive its fruit. Who are these servants? Well, Isaiah chapter 5 doesn't really help us here because it doesn't mention the servants whatsoever. But we have a good idea, and Matthew loves what we call the triads. If you'll notice in the book of Matthew, he speaks in groups of three. It's a very, very common theme throughout the book of Matthew. By the way, it has nothing to do with the Trinity. It has to do with his writing style. And he uses it here in his allegory. He says that, verse 35, and the vine dressers took his servants, the landowners, beat one, killed one, and stoned another. There's the triad. Again, he sent other servants, more than the first, and they did likewise. Boom, boom, boom. Then last of all, he sent his son. But who are these servants who were beat and killed and stoned? Who are God's servants? Well, we read from one, Isaiah, the prophets. These were the servants that God sent, right? These are the servants that God had sent throughout all eternity who were indeed not listened to, not respected. Many were killed. Many were stoned. Many were sent into exile. We know that Israel rejected prophet after prophet after prophet. And so that's who he's talking about here with the servants. The landowner's son in this allegory, we know. But see, you've had it explained to you. You've read it. The people listening at this time, this was new to them. This was a parable. In fact, it even took the intelligentsia, who we know as the chief priests and the Pharisees, it took them a little while to figure it out. The landowner's son, it is Jesus. In fact, remember who's speaking these words? It's him. This is one of the very few places in the New Testament where we say there is self-revelatory words. In other words, Jesus literally talks about his own life. He talks about himself. He is God's son. And what is going to happen to him? So these self-revelatory words are very important. They plot to kill him. When the vine dressers saw the son, verse 38, they said among themselves, they plot. This is the heir. Come, let us kill him and seize an inheritance. A plot. They took him, they threw him out of the vineyard, and they killed him, which is another triad. Indeed, Jesus was arrested or seized. He was taken from Jerusalem outside the vineyard, and there he was killed, exactly as in the parable. So everything is fitting. The rejected stone of Isaiah is also in Isaiah. Is talking basically about Jesus again. He is the stumbling block. He is the cornerstone, or more correctly, the capstone. When I was back east, if you've ever seen an archway built out of stone, there is a capstone, right? Or a lynchstone, or a keystone. You pull that keystone out of the top of an arch or a doorway, the whole thing comes down. So this is the thing that they rejected. It's a very important part of a building. They had rejected it. And this again speaks about Jesus, and Jesus is speaking about himself. Who will they give the vine vineyard to? They will give this to other vine growers or vine dressers who will pay the proceeds to the landowner at the proper time. Who are they? Who are these other vine dressers? There's an easy answer. We know who it's not. The new vine dressers will not be the old vine dressers. They will not be the current leadership. It will not be the current chief priests and Pharisees. They will be thrown out. Those people that will be the new vine dressers will be those who properly care for the vineyard, who will give fruit in its due season. Now I have a question for you. Why did the current leaders, the chief priests and the Pharisees, did not provide fruit in due season? Was it a bad year? Did they have a bad crop? Were they poor stewards? Did they keep the proceeds to themselves? What happened? What happened? Had those in the care of the vineyard during Jesus' day done what they were asked to do, none of this would have happened. The parable would never have been spoken, never been written. We'd never read it. So I love to ask, why did they not produce the fruit that was required? What happened is clear. It wasn't produced. Why? Why? The reason was God was not happy, not pleased, and there was no produce. But why? We could indeed, and unfortunately that's what a lot of the commentators do, they focus upon the poor chief priests and the Pharisees. They're bad. We boo. We hiss. We know they're usually the bad guys. They've got the black hats on. They're found wanting. They never do God's will. And they're not producing the attitude Jesus asked. We could also focus on unbelieving Israel. They rejected the Messiah. These people that seem to say all the right things when Jesus gives a parable, they rejected the Messiah. But Jesus used Isaiah 5 as a pretext for this parable that we know so well. What is the key here? I believe it is buried in verse 34. He says, "Now when vintage time drew near, he sent his servants to the vine dressers that they might receive its fruit." They might receive its fruit. But they were never given this fruit during vintage or harvest time. Why? Why were they never given? What is this? What is the produce that was expected and not delivered? Was it wine? Was it wine? Was it grapes? Was it fruit? He expected fruit. Because if you have no vines, you have no wine. If you have no grapes, you have no fruit or wine. This fruit, what was it that he expected? You know, when people reference one thing, it provokes the thought of something else. If I were to say to you, plain truth, most of you would say, magazine. I used to receive it. It would conjure up an image in your head. If I were to say, we heard it earlier, Ambassador College, it would conjure things in your head. If I were to say, the USC Trojans should be number one in the country and they're not, that would probably conjure up quite a few things in your head as it does in mine. But if I say the imagery of Matthew 24 and the prophecies, or if I say John 3:16, you will know exactly what I'm saying. So too it was with Isaiah chapter 5 in the time of Jesus. It was a very, very well-known parable. It was a very well-known section from the book of Isaiah, and it was important to them. The vineyard itself is a problem. The vineyard is the problem. It is not producing grapes. It's producing bad fruit. Turn with me, if you would, in Isaiah chapter 5. We'll read it again. Sometimes we do need to speak of the bad to speak of the good. Now, when we speak to God's people and you have His Spirit, sometimes we want you to understand the good things by mentioning sometimes, unfortunately, a lot of bad. He says again, verse 1, chapter 5 of Isaiah, "Now let me sing to my well-beloved a song of my beloved regarding his vineyard. My well-beloved has a vineyard on a very fruitful hill. He dug it up and cleared out its stones and planted it with choicest vine. He built a tower in the midst and also made a winepress in it. So he expected it to bring forth good grapes." Brethren, he's not talking about a vineyard. He's not talking about a tower. He's not talking about a fruitful hill. He's not talking about anything about a vineyard, is he? It has nothing to do with a vineyard. He's not talking about good grapes. He doesn't expect good grapes out of this vineyard. It is an allegory. "But it brought forth wild grapes. things he couldn't use, things he didn't want. And verse 3, "And now, O inhabitants of Jerusalem and men of Judah, judge please between me and my vineyard. What more could I have done to my vineyard that I have not done in it? Why then, when I expected it to bring forth good grapes, did it bring forth wild grapes? And now, please, let me tell you what I will do in my vineyard. I will take away its hedge, and it shall be burned. I will break down its wall, and it shall be trampled down. I will lay it waste. It shall not be pruned or dug, but there shall come up briars and thorns. I will also command the clouds that they will not rain upon it. For the vineyard of the Eternal of Hosts is the house of Israel, and the men of Judah are his pleasant plant. He looked for justice, but behold, oppression; for righteousness, but behold, a cry for help." It's interesting, and I was listening to Mr. Buchanan, is this church teaches, and I do firmly believe, this is Israel. I do believe it. It is the most blessed, it is the most favored, it is the most honored of all God's nations on this earth. There is nothing greater or a greater beacon of hope and liberty than this country. Is it? And the what we call, and unfortunately it's grown with the use, is the term the Israelitish nations. They are still of the most blessed, the most honored, the most favored of all that God has. I think it is indeed talking to the Israel. It says, verse 7, "For the vineyard of the Eternal of Hosts is the house of Israel, and the men of Judah are his pleasant plant. He looked for justice," i.e. grapes, good grapes, grapes that he had planted and expected to come up. But he says, "But behold, oppression, bad grapes, wild grapes, grapes he didn't want, produce or fruit, we would call. For righteousness is what he planted, but behold, he received a cry for help. Woe to those who join house to house and add field to field till there is nowhere to go, no place." Anybody in Southern California has probably the best idea of what this possibly could mean than anywhere else in the world. A lot of us have traveled all over this country. There is no place like Southern California. I'm a native. But we passed housing development after housing development after housing development in the 90 miles that we drive to San Diego to see you. We see house after house after house. We see vacant house after vacant house. We see plot of land after plot of land that has been graded and pads upon it. They are empty, aren't they? They are empty. If anyone in this country or on this planet has an idea of what this could possibly mean, it is here. It is here. Brethren, they do not have these developments in Ohio or Kentucky or Texas or Nevada or Washington like they have them here. Like they have them here. So if of all people, we should understand. He says, In my hearing, the Lord of hosts has said, truly many houses shall be desolate, great and beautiful ones without inhabitant. For 10 acres of vineyard shall yield one bath, and an omer of seed shall yield one ephah. Now, I'm not saying that Southern California is the epitome of God wreaking havoc upon Israel, but it is indicative. I believe that God gives us these little glimpses so that we'll understand. Isn't that what parents do for children? They give them a small taste of what could happen without allowing the full brunt of the evil upon them. We give them little tastes. We give them, you see what can happen? You see what can occur? And I think that's what we see today in our nation, which was so well said by Mr. Buchanan. I don't want to keep referencing poor Mr. Buchanan, but I think the messages had a common theme. He says, verse 11, "Woe to those who rise early in the morning that they may follow intoxicating drink, who continue until night, all till wine inflames them, the harp and the strings, the tambourine and flute, and wine are in their feasts. And they do not regard the work of the Eternal, nor consider the operation of his hands. Therefore my people have gone into captivity, because they have no knowledge. Their honorable men are famished." They're gone. The honorable men are gone. "And their multitude dried up with thirst. For Sheol, or the grave, has enlarged itself and opened its mouth beyond measure, their glory and their multitude and their pomp. And he who is jubilant," and it means in a bad way, shall descend into it. In other words, the pit or Sheol. People shall be brought down, each man shall be humbled, and the eyes of the lofty shall be humbled. But the Eternal of hosts shall be exalted in judgment, and God who is holy shall be hallowed in righteousness. Then the lambs shall feed in their pasture, and in the waste places the fat ones, the strangers, shall eat. The rest of the chapter goes on and on and on about the evil that will one day overtake this world and the nations. But I want to concentrate on two good spots, two positive spots in all of this in verses 15 and 16. It references two very interesting words. One is, each man shall be humbled, and the eyes of the lofty shall be humbled. But the Eternal of hosts shall be exalted in judgment, and God who is holy shall be hallowed in righteousness. Humility and righteousness. Humility is something that you feel, or something that you have as an attitude. It is a very difficult thing to obtain, isn't it? Especially in the climate of the world that we live in. There are some wonderful people to emulate, but it is a difficult thing to obtain. And that is one of humility, an attitude that we have. It's the way we think. See, humility is something in our head and our heart. It's what we have internally. But the righteousness in the original speaks about something that is external. When we are right in mind, we are right in action. And the two very often don't occur together. But the righteousness that is spoken of here is spoken of as acts of righteousness, where we forgive and we understand and we help, especially those of the household of faith, where we look to one another for help, where we have this attitude of humility of always putting another brother or sister above oneself. These are the two attitudes tucked away inside all these verses of death and destruction. And we know it's going to happen. It is inevitable. Unfortunately, evil will triumph for a time over good. That's what these verses say. But we know and we believe and we teach that ultimately that humility and righteousness, God's righteousness, contained in right actions according to His law, will eventually win out. So let me leave you with the same thoughts that we've heard throughout this day on the Sabbath that God has given us. It is the things that we think, the things that we do. We are God's vineyard. We are holy to God. He wants us to produce good fruit. He wants us to think good thoughts. He wants us to act according to the righteousness that we know that He gives us.